G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Truth2U's China correspondent, Nehemia Gordon. G'day, my friend.
Ni hao, g'day. How you doing, Jono? Shalom.
Ni hao and g'day. And it's been a while since you and I've been able to talk because, you've been a little bit hard to track down. You've been on vacation.
Yeah, you know, I'm here in China working as a teacher, and we had a month-long vacation for Chinese New Year, which I just found out actually yesterday is a 15-day holiday. Like the actual holiday, you know, I call this 8 days of Christmas, and I think it's 8 days of Christmas. Or it's 12 days of Christmas, sorry, and 8 days of Hanukkah.
12 days of Christmas, my true love said to me.
I'm Jewish, I don't know how many days there are of Christmas. There's 12 days of Christmas and 8 days of Hanukkah and 8 days sort of Sukkot, seven or eight. And so there's apparently 15 days of the Chinese New Year, and so they gave us a month vacation just to... I'm not really sure why. And so I decided to travel to a place where the air wasn't choking me, which was a place in southern China called Yunnan. And then after Yunnan, I ended up going to Laos and Cambodia. And it was really incredible. I saw some really amazing places, learned so much about Chinese culture, Eastern culture, and as well as about Western, meaning about our own Western culture that I didn't realize, but I only realized by contrasting it to, you know, things that Chinese people told me, and I realized, wait a minute, I thought all people saw things the way we see things, but that's actually a characteristic of our culture in the West.
Really?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I know. I want to talk about some of those examples. Hold on to that, because before we talk about those examples, I just want to get this straight. I understand that you had an encounter with an elephant. Can we just get that out of the way? Can you just tell the listeners what happened with the elephant before you tell us
about it? Let's start with the monkey, okay? Remember there was a monkey that tried to kill me about a year ago?
There was a monkey because you went on a trek and you pulled out some peanuts and waved them in front of the monkey. And you said, hey, monkey, what are you reckon about? I'm going to eat these in front of you, but I'm not going to give you any.
So I was in Laos. They were my peanuts.
Remind the people. So then the monkey said, well, I'll show you. So he went and got some of his mates. And the people that you were with said, you better run. And you said, why? And he said, because he's going to get his friends. And so the monkeys were after you. Now you're taunting elephants.
And these were wild monkeys. Well, I was in Laos. And one of the things you do in Laos is they have like the mahout training. Mahout is the elephant driver, and you can actually train to be a mahout, and it's really kind of a gimmick. They don't really train you to be a mahout, but I got to ride the elephant and take him, and I had this bag of peanuts, and I said, no, I'm leaving these in the hotel, because if the elephant comes for me, I'm dead, it's over. And everybody knows elephants love peanuts, but I did feed the elephant bananas. And she loved them. And there were a couple elephants. One of them took them with her trunk, and they're all girls because apparently the boys are too, the male elephants are a little bit too aggressive for tourists. So one of them like actually took the bananas with her trunk and put it in her mouth, and it was really cool. The other one, the one that I was riding, she's like, no, I don't want to use my trunk. Stick it in my mouth. So I had to like actually stick it in her mouth, which was slimy and gooey and disgusting. And it was kind of cool. But then part of the mahout training was that when we were done riding the elephants, we took them down into the river to bathe, and we're riding on these elephants. And this was in the Mekong River, the famous Mekong River that runs through China, Laos, Cambodia, and finally, as most Americans know, Vietnam. And in the Mekong River, I'm bathing this elephant, and really I'm just riding on her neck, and she's bathing. And then she does this weird thing with her trunk and swishes her head back and forth, and I go flying into the Mekong River, swallowing the dirty, disgusting water of the Mekong River, thinking I'm going to die. I'm underwater, and you know. But then I got up and got right back on the elephant. And you know, once when I was a kid, I was thrown from a horse, and I did the same exact thing. I got right back on. And that's what I did with this elephant. You know, you can throw me off, Miss Elephant, but I'm getting back on. And
getting back on the elephant, which you did after
the... But I actually went flying, and the next day I was in excruciating pain from, you know, it hurts being thrown from an elephant.
I doubt it, even though you landed in water. Now, the water that you landed in, you said it goes through a number of countries. And what kind of water are we talking about? I mean, is this sort of, you know, southern Jordan River water or...
It's kind of southern Jordan River water, meaning it's really like you see the sewage flowing into the river. At one place when I actually did jungle trek, and I was hiking out in the jungle, and we stayed in this little village, And in the morning, we were walking along the river, and we saw them bathing, washing a dog in the river.
Oh, yeah.
And then also washing a motorcycle. And I thought, oh, my gosh. Like, people are drinking this water. People are, you know, like, washing their fruits and vegetables in this water, literally. And they're washing a dog and a motorcycle in the water. And this is just one spot on a river that runs for, I don't know, maybe like 1,000 miles or something.
Wow. That's incredible. All right. Yes, so there's one of the adventures that
it's very beautiful.
You experienced. So there was, you didn't pick up any cooties, right? You were okay.
As far as I know, you know, there might be some microorganisms I have that I'm not aware of, but you know, it's incredible. It's actually incredible.
The holiday continued. The vacation continued. What happened after that?
Exactly. I didn't get sick even once the whole time. Beautiful. You know, with gastrointestinal issues, which many people do, but I didn't drink the water except for those gulps in the Mekong.
Okay. Continuing on with your vacation, what happened next?
Oh, I mean, just so much happened. you know, I did two jungle treks. The first one I did in China, and it's actually one of the last remaining sections of jungle in China. And I was told by this French man in a cafe that, oh, you don't need a guide. It's very clear where the trail is, and it's an easy walk. It's no problem. And he drew me a map, and he said, you walk 45 minutes down this trail, and you jump over a barbed wire fence, and you go down into the – and I'm like, this is perfect. This is exactly my type of hike. And I get there, and I end up getting lost in the jungle. And look, it was really, 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 really hot, and which is ironic because right now I'm back in Changsha in central China, and it's snowing outside my window right now.
Oh, really?
But this was in southwestern China in a place called Shishuangbanna. And Shishuangbanna is really, really hot. And it was actually right near the Burmese border. And I was warned that if you get stopped by the army – just show them your passport, and they'll tell you to head turn back and then just go around them. That's what I was told by the Frenchman. Anyway, so I'm hiking through this jungle, and I get lost, and I come to a cliff, and the trail ends. I'm like, wait a minute. I've been following this well-marked trail, and it's over. And I'm thinking, like, I don't even know how to get back to where I came from. And I realized I was almost out of water. And it's interesting because I thought, you know, there's a potential here that I could – if I don't get back by sunset to the road, I could die in this jungle is what I started to think. And it's interesting what flashes through your head when you start to think about. And one of the things that I thought about is, okay, when they find my body, I'm you know – I mean, it's really what I was thinking. You know, they'll find my cell phone, and I want to record my last thoughts and –
sure.
It's interesting what you start to think about, and yeah, you know, it really puts life in perspective when you think you could potentially die.
How long had you been walking until you got to the cliff?
So I had been walking at that point. Let's see. I had been walking around 6.5 hours,
and then, good heavens!
Yeah, and then to get back took me another 2.5 hours. But I didn't know that at the time. I thought if it takes me 6.5 hours to get back, I'm done for. Like this, I didn't have the energy. Even, you know, and it only took 2.5 hours because I didn't get as lost on the way back as I did on the way there.
And so as a result, you had some very deep reflection is what you're saying.
I really did. It was profound. It was.
So what are some of the things that went through your mind?
You know, one of the things that went through my mind is something that I've been taught since I was a small child, which is that the last words on your lips when you die should be the Shema.
Shema.
And Shema Yisrael, Yehovah Eloheinu, Yehovah Echad. Hear, O Israel, Yehovah is our God, Yehovah is one. And, you know, earlier I was hiking in this other place in China, and I started to think about, you know, there's a lot of controversy, especially in the Messianic world, about what Echad means. You know, Echad is the Hebrew word for one. And, and I was climbing up this ladder. And this ladder is reputed to be 50 meters long. Which is like 150 feet. In China, they exaggerate everything, so I think it was probably only like 70 feet. But whatever, it was pretty scary. It was a ladder on a cliff, and the metal ladder was tied to a wooden ladder, and the wooden ladder, the old wooden ladder, was tied to a third ladder, which was then attached to the mountain. I'm thinking, like, is this ladder really designed for someone of my quite frankly, size. You know, Chinese people are often very small. And I'm thinking, sure. Oh my gosh. And I am grabbing on for dear life to each rung. And at one point, I run out of strength because I had actually been hiking for 2 days at that point. This was in a place called Tiger Leaping Gorge, and which is one of the most beautiful places on Earth. So I'm climbing up this ladder, and my arms start to shake because there's what they call that lactic acid in your muscles, I'm climbing the ladder. I'm grabbing on to each rung for dear life, and I start to say the Shema, and I decide, okay, so for each rung that I can accomplish, I'm going to say one word of the Shema, and that's kind of like a way for me not to think about, like, OMG, there's like 50 more rugs left, I'm not going to make it, you know. So I get to a chad, and I start to think that I'm grabbing onto this rung, and then there's one rung there, single rung, you know, rung of a ladder, and it's one. And the oneness of that rung is my life depends on it. Because all of a sudden, if I blink my eyes and there's three, like, I'm in trouble.
Well, yeah, you got a problem. Yeah, you got a serious problem.
I mean, it's one in a very real and tangible sense, and to me, that's what echad is. One of the most profound places I went to was Cambodia, and I went there to a place called the Killing Fields. Mm-hmm. And after the Holocaust, people said never again. There'll never be we can't let there be another genocide in the world where millions of people are killed. And it happened. It happened in Cambodia, and it happened because the communists took over Cambodia, and they decided to kill anybody who they had this ideal that. To create an agrarian society, that everybody should be farmers. So anybody who was considered an intellectual was killed. Anybody who wore glasses was killed. Anybody who can't, no. Because they said if you wear glasses, you must read, and therefore you're not, you're disconnected from the land, and you're a foreign influence, and you should be killed.
You know what that reminds me of, Nehemiah? It reminds me of the pictures that I've seen of Nazis measuring people's noses to see whether or not they were determined to be Jewish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, these people were insane. And this was a pure product of communism. That was called the Khmer Rouge, or the Red Khmer. The Khmer is the name of the people of Cambodia. That's their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So the Red Khmer, the Khmer Rouge, they... arrived on April 17th, 1975 in the capital of Phnom Penh, which had about 2 million people in it, and within 24 hours, the city was empty. They forced the people in the countryside to become rice farmers. Now, these were city folk. They didn't know how to be rice farmers. Many of them died just on this march at gunpoint. I mean, imagine, I read some of the accounts. These students were in a classroom, and the teachers, explaining how the Khmer Rouge soldier shows up in his classroom and says, okay, everybody in the countryside right now. And the students said, well, we need to go home and tell our parents, no, now. Well, we need to go get our clothes and pack, no, now, at gunpoint. And people died just on the march. I mean, it's shocking. It's unbelievable. Mm. But it happens. 2 million people died out of a population of 8 million people. That's one in four.
2 million.
If you spoke English or French, which were the international languages at the time, they killed you. If you had, any kind of university degree, you were dead. The country started the war with, I believe it was 800 doctors, medical doctors. 55 survived the Khmer Rouge. And those were the people who pretended they weren't doctors. They hid as, they played dumb. I mean, it was insane. And this is communism at its purest. They followed it to its logical conclusion. And this is what the monster that they created. And so I went to see those places, and it's heart-wrenching. There's this one tree that in the killing fields where they would take children and babies, especially babies and, toddlers, 2, 3 years old as well, and they would take them by the legs and smash their heads against the tree. And you walk around this place in the killing fields, and there's still bone fragments everywhere. And the people who run the site, they say every 2 to 3 months we go around the site and we pick up the bone fragments and the clothing fragments of the victims, but they just ooze out of the earth. And it really reminded me of, there's so many people who were killed there. It reminded me of Treblinka, in Poland, which was one of the death factories of the Nazis. And it's the same thing there. There are these potato fields, and next, part of what was Treblinka during the Holocaust, and so every year when they plow those fields, just bone fragments and cloth fragments come up. Really? I was there. I saw it. It's horrific. And this is what
these are some of the incredibly reflective, sober reflective moments that you had to dwell on while you were on your vacation. I mean, this is an incredible vacation.
And then I went to the next city, which was called Siem Reap, also in Cambodia. And one of the most bizarre things in my entire life happens. I was being driven in a sort of like a bus thing. And the driver asked if he said to me, he says, "You want Boom Boom, 15 years old, $100. And I'm like, what did you just say? He was trying to pimp out some girl who was a 15-year-old girl for $100. And I rebuked him. I told him this was evil and wrong and should be. I don't know if it's illegal in Cambodia or not, but it should be. And he said, "Okay, 16 years old, $70. And I was shocked. I was very shocked.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah. And this is a pretty common thing in this part of the world, as far as I understand. I mean, they're very, very poor. A large percentage of Cambodians and people from Laos, Laotians, live under the international poverty level, which, from what I read, means they're subsisting on less than $1.25 a day, which is hard to comprehend. You know, when Americans, you know, will spend $4.50 on a cup of Starbucks, and I among them, I'm not, you know, pointing the finger at other people. And then you think, well, that's 4 days' salary for many people around the world. It really puts things in perspective.
So these are the as you say, it puts things in perspective. So you were going to talk about some of the differences in philosophy between various countries.
I met a lot of really interesting people, and one of the people I met was this Japanese Buddhist, and she was telling me about what Buddhism is all about. And I actually studied Buddhism in university. I studied comparative religions. And so, so I thought I knew quite a bit about Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism. But I got the big picture. I didn't get the nitty gritty of some of the philosophy. And she was telling me that, she said, Buddhism starts with the premise that the world is full of suffering. You know, people suffer. And it's really inevitable in Buddhism, in the Buddhist philosophy. And so what Buddhism teaches you to do is transcend the suffering by attaining a state of higher consciousness. I mean, basically they meditate, attain a state of higher consciousness, and so you put your mind above the suffering and thereby escape it. And it got me thinking about, the Torah actually accepts that principle that the world is full of suffering. I mean, that's really, something that's talked about, especially in Deuteronomy and really all the prophets. That's their one of the central messages is all the suffering in the world. There's the poor and the downtrodden, but what the Torah teaches us is not to transcend the suffering through meditation. On the contrary, to try to make the world a better place. That's what the Torah is all about, is through love and obedience to Yehovah, and through love of Yehovah and our fellow man, our objective is to reduce the suffering.
And be a light to the nations.
Light to the nations and make the world a better place. And then this ultimately will culminate with the coming of the Messiah who will bring world peace. And it's really a profoundly different philosophy. The Buddhists just accept that the world is full of suffering, and they want to escape the world. And if you think about it, so the ultimate thing in Buddhism, as I understand it, what was explained to me, is to be a monk, and the monk detaches from the world. And in Judaism, we've never had this concept of monasticism, of separating oneself from the world. The ultimate in the Torah is to be part of the world. The world is not evil. People in the world do evil. God created the world and saw that it was good, and he created man and saw he was very good. But then people choose to do evil, and that's why there's suffering in the world. And and the goal is not to separate oneself from the world and live on a hilltop by yourself in solitude, but on the contrary, to be part of the world. To be, to engage in the world and make it a better place, and the difference is just profound to me.
And so, you had a conversation with the Buddhist, and I know also that is there a significant Hindu presence as well? Is that also a dominant religion?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So the place I visited, which was Laos and Cambodia, is, you know, part of an area called Indochina. And it really is a mix of Indian and Chinese culture. And people even told me that, like locals there said, you know, we're both Chinese and Indian in our culture. And so one of the places I went to in Cambodia was Angkor Wat, which is considered the largest religious structure in the world. It was built in 1150, completed in 1150 CE. Wow. So that makes it like 850 years old approximately, and 860 years old. And it
This is a temple. It's a temple.
It's a temple, right? It's a massive temple complex, and it was built as a Hindu temple by the king of the Khmer. The Khmer is the name of the ethnicity of the ethnic group that lives in Cambodia. They call themselves Khmer.
Right.
So I mentioned before the Khmer Rouge. That's the Red Khmer. Those are the people who committed genocide. But 900 years ago, there was a kingdom, an empire actually called the Khmer Empire, which covered all of Indochina. Most of Indochina was what today is Thailand, Myanmar or Burma, Laos, Cambodia, parts of Vietnam were all part of the Khmer Empire, and the capital was Angkor Wat, and they built, you know, the king built a temple there to honor his gods. And they were Hindu gods. It was a Hindu temple when it was built. And it's really interesting because one of the things that I saw there was this three-headed elephant. Now, I had just ridden on an elephant a week before in Laos. And so I was asking the tour guide, what is the significance of this three-headed elephant? And he explained to me a concept that I somehow missed when I, you know, studied Hinduism. And like I said, when I studied comparative religions, I was getting the big picture. And this is one of the more specific doctrines of Hinduism, which is that there is something called the Trimurti, T-R-I-M-U-R-T-I, Trimurti, which is, and I may be mispronouncing it, but the Trimurti or Trimurti is this concept in Hinduism that the ultimate real power in the universe is a triune god, a god that is both three and one at the same time. And he's really one, but he has three manifestations, and so he's represented by this elephant that has three heads. And this is a very important
Let me get this
symbol.
Straight. I just want to get the imagery straight in my head. Are we talking about an elephant with three heads, or are we talking about a human body with three elephant heads?
No, it's an elephant with three heads. Because an elephant
is a
sacred animal to them.
It's an elephant with three elephant heads. Okay.
Right.
And it's a trinity, if you like. It's a trinity.
Well, they call it a Trimurti, but I mean, I think in the West we would call it a trinity. But basically those three gods are really three manifestations of the same god. One of them is the creator of the universe. The other is the sustainer of the universe. And the third one's ultimately the destroyer of the universe. And Hindus look at it as a cycle, that there's this cycle of history, creation, sustaining, and destruction. And then after that, there'll be another creation. And so those three gods are really one, three manifestations of the same god. They are three in one, which I was really surprised. Like, I didn't know that was part of the Hindu faith. And such an important part of the faith, like, this was actually on the main gate of the entrance of this of one of these temple complexes was, you know, the three-headed elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also told me that in other places, and I didn't see this myself, but in other places there's a three-headed snake. And he said the three-headed snake represents the same thing. It's the three manifestations of, or the three modes, or however you want to describe it, the three persons. And some of the literature I looked up actually describes them as three persons of the Hindu Trinity, which is really interesting.
Isn't it? So it's actually quite an older concept. I remember Hani, when she was studying ancient world religion, that she came across this as well and was detailing me how in fact, ancient that concept is of a triune god. What's fascinating is that it is fairly common throughout various religions around the world.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting to me that, you know, in ancient, you know, Hinduism and in many other religions, you have this Trimurti, which is a Sanskrit word. That's not the English word. That's the ancient Indian word for it. This triune deity, which is three and one at the same time. It's really, like, you know, found in many religions and many cultures. And, you know, I asked myself, you know, from my perspective, like, how did that come about? And I have a theory of how that came about. I mean, some people have actually argued that there's this universal theme of triads of, you know, and of course, and look, I want to make it clear, I'm not talking about Christianity. So, you know, Christians will say, well, but theirs is, you know, fundamentally different because, you know, they've got a whole theology behind it that, that explains it as being different than the other ones. And so I don't even want to get into that. I'm really more interested from, you know, and that really didn't even come about until like the third or fourth century AD. So what I'm more interested in is these really early religions who have these triads, these triple gods that are three in one. And what it says to me is there may be something here that goes back to, you know, the Tower of Babel, when all of mankind was together at one time and then they were dispersed.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were dispersed, there were certain things that they remembered, but they got confused. And if you look at the flood stories that exist in every culture in the world, I mean, you have flood stories that are preserved by the Maya, but their details of the flood story, as you get farther and farther away from the land of Israel, the flood story gets more and more confused. You know, you have the flood story in Babylon where they remember that a bird was sent out to see if the flood had ended. I mean, they remember specific details from what actually happened. Whereas you get, you know, go across the Atlantic Ocean and well, the whole world was destroyed by a flood and we don't really remember any you know, details about it. And maybe there's a similar thing happening with this triune, you know, deity concept that, you know, we're told that the first generation to call upon the name Yehovah was in the generation of Enosh. You know, it says Azucha Likul B'Shem Yehovah. Then they began to call up, or then it was began to call upon the name of Yehovah. That's at the end of, I believe, of Genesis chapter 5. Sure. And you know, the name Yehovah itself is from three Hebrew words: Hayahoveh Hiyeh, He that was, He that is, and He that will be. And I understand when it says in the Shema that Yehovah is one, that He really is one. He's one. He's the same one in the past, in the present, and the future. And but the point for us, for telling us, you know, Yehovah, Hayahoveh Hiyeh, is that He always is, He always will be, and He always was. Mm-hmm. And maybe as they were dispersed throughout the flood, they understood that to be essentially one God with three different faces. You know, that's why maybe in Hinduism you have the, you know, the one who created the world, the one who maintains the world, and the one who in the future will recreate the world or destroy the world or whatever. It's a perversion of the true Hebrew concept, which is Hayahoveh Hiyeh, He that was, He that is, and He that will be. And that would explain why you have this triune deity concept in all these religions throughout the world. It's the babble, the confusion of the true faith of Noah and his descendants and of Adam, which is that there's one true God who was, is, and always will be.
I think that is absolutely plausible, that you put it like that, and I think it's absolutely plausible, and that it would descend or devolve, if you like, into three, as you were saying, three personas, three faces.
Right, and you know, it's like what I saw in Cambodia was the elephant with three heads. And if you think about it, it makes sense that you have these ancient ideas that as they are dispersed away from Israel, they get more and more corrupted. You know, I'm here in China, and one of the things you see everywhere, especially around this time of year, is you see the entrance of the door, and it has the blood on the side post and over the lintel. And it's not actual blood. It's, you know, it's now printed red parchment or, you know, paper, but you know, it and they tell the story that originally there was this dragon that would come and would eat the children, and they found out the dragon was afraid of red, so at the entrance of their house they put red to keep them away. Well, wow. We know the original story, which is that it was Yehovah sending the angel of death out across Egypt, but by the time it gets to China, maybe over 1,000 years later, the story has become so corrupt and confused that now we're talking about dragons eating children. But the basic kernel of truth is still preserved in that story. And I think maybe that's what's going on in India, that this is a perversion of the true faith, which has, you know, become this this three-headed monster.
The three-headed monster is I often refer to it. No, that makes so much sense.
It's Yehovah, Hayahoveh, he is, he was, He who is, he was, he is, and he will always be, has now become essentially a god with three heads instead of the one, the Echad, the one true God.
Based on his name, which is the contraction of those three words. But obviously he has one face.
He's one. Yep.
And you talk about that, you actually talk about that in some detail in your book, Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence, the Hebrew Power of the Priestly Blessing Unleashed, because you talk about the priestly blessing that talks about his face shining upon us.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's not a three-headed monster face. It's one face.
It's not three faces shining. Thank goodness for that.
There ain't trunks. No. The elephant. He's not an elephant even. I mean, this is, you know, part of the corruption.
Amen.
Yeah. Oh, and here's actually, if you Google it, you can see actually like there's one man with three heads, but that's not what I saw. So, like I said, what I saw was an infant with three heads, not a man with three heads. But there is a man with three faces. And it's interesting that the word person, if you look up the history of that word in Latin, it's persona, and that comes from a Greek word that means face or a mask. You know, there was three faces. So, but anyway, the one that I saw, so it's Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the maintainer or preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer or transformer. It's the one elephant with three heads, and if been thrown from even one elephant head, it's not a pleasant experience.
So let me ask you a question about that's right. Let me ask you a question about the temples. As a Jew, I mean, as a Torah observant Jew, is it weird for you to be visiting pagan temples like this?
It definitely was in a sense, meaning there was a certain amount of uncomfortableness. I won't deny it. In fact, I embrace it. You know, for me, going to these temples is really, I want to learn about paganism. And why do I want to learn about paganism? The Torah forbids us not to do these things. Well, when at the time the Torah was forbidding these things, you know, Baal was worshipped and Asherah and Ashtoreth and all these, you know, false deities were known by name. And statues were everywhere. Well, the culture I grew up in, one of the things I was actually taught growing up is that the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, which is kind of the rabbinical concept of Satan, that he was blinded. And ever since he was blinded, people don't worship idols anymore. There was this yearning, this intense desire to worship idols. And that's why in the Tanakh people worshiped idols. But now that he's been blinded, nobody worships idols anymore. That's what I was taught. And then I go around the world and I see people still worship idols. And I realize this isn't true. Like maybe maybe in the Jewish world, we have overcome the desire for idolatry. Maybe we haven't, and we're in denial. Maybe we're kidding ourselves. But certainly the literal idolatry that's described in the Tanakh, you know, you can't find it in the world I grew up in. But you definitely see it in a very literal sense still being practiced in some parts of the world. So for me, this is sort of like an anthropological exploration of, you know, what is idolatry about? And I go there and I see literal idolatry. And they're still burning incense to these idols. I mean, this is not something that passed away, you know, 800, 900 years ago. This is an actively used temple. In fact, it was very strange because there were these idols of naked women all over the temple. Not naked, but they were basically naked. You know, like they were very immodestly dressed. But at the entrance, they make all the women, visitors, cover their shoulders. Like if you're wearing a tank top, they won't let you in.
Wow.
And I made the remark to one of the guards. I said, but the statues are their shoulders aren't covered. Their breasts aren't covered. But you're making that woman put on a t-shirt? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Did he have an answer to that?
No, he didn't. He said, you know, this is our culture and our tradition. Oh, okay, but you're a hypocrite. But anyway, but to me, the point is that this is an actively used temple. It's considered a holy site to this day, to the point where they'll make people dress a certain way when they enter out of respect for the sanctity. So to me, going there, there was a certain uncomfortableness, especially smelling the incense. That was very uncomfortable for me. To me,
that's the
ultimate. Because to me, that's the ultimate expression of idolatry. When I go into a place and I smell incense, and I'm reminded of the rabbinical midrash, the legend about why Jacob, or no, I'm sorry, not Jacob, why Isaac went blind. This is one of the stories they tell. You know, he went blind in his old age, and the rabbis tell the story. It's because Esav. His son Esav had married these, heathen women and these Canaanites, and they burned incense, and the smoke of the incense blinded Isaac.
Oh, wow.
Which is not what it says in the Tanakh, but it's a cute little story. And so every time I smell the incense, I think of that story. And to me, it represents, you know, it's a strange fire. Any incense not offered in the Temple of Jerusalem, according to the specific formulation by the high priest as part of a set ritual, is a strange fire and detestable to Jehovah. We're told that in the Torah. And so I smell this incense in it, and it's very disturbing to me. And, you know, I actually was originally going to do 3 days of touring. They said, you've got to do the third day. You know, there's more temples to see. And after the second day, I said, no, I've seen enough pagan temples. I'm done.
Right. And so you're obviously, while you're touring there, the land is polluted with idols. The air is polluted with the incense, which is kind of creeping you out. But then eventually you do return to China, where the air is seriously polluted. You began this conversation by mentioning that, but just break it down to the listeners.
Well, within 30 minutes of landing in Changsha, I had a headache and I was coughing, and you know, I remarked to you before the program that China and Saturn's moon, I believe it's Titan. Yeah, Saturn's moon Titan. Yes. Both have something in common.
Something in common.
And what do they have in common? That's that the atmosphere is visible.
both atmospheres.
Both have a visible atmosphere.
I mean, you get off the plane and you can see the air.
Oh, you see it. I mean, it's visible. And for a whole month, I was out of that, you know, in places with clean air where you can see the moon and you can see the blue sky. And I come here and I'm wrapped in this haze of pollution. And it's tangible. I mean, you feel it. Like I said, within 30 minutes, I had a splitting headache, and I could smell the ozone, you know, which is a byproduct of the car manufacturing here. Man. So yeah, that's mainland China. And people just
that's hard work.
It.
But you were telling me that it's snowing outside. I mean, what does it do to the snow? Is it gray snow? I mean,
no, actually, it's white right now. But no, it's white snow. Yeah, and we may be having a day of, you know, clean air. I don't know. But
what about the rain? Because you mentioned to me something about the rice. I mean, in the area where you are, there's you were telling me about the rice belt. I mean, in the States, they have the wheat belt.
Right. So I live in Hunan, which is really the equivalent of Kansas in the U.S. You know, Hunan is to rice what Kansas is to wheat, and maybe what, you know, Illinois or Indiana is to corn. This is one of the major rice producing areas of the world, Hunan. And one of the problems here is that the rice has been found to be tainted with cadmium, which is a heavy metal. And why it's tainted with cadmium?
Is that from the rain? I mean, does it come down through the atmosphere?
Well, so what happens is they're trying to industrialize the province of Hunan, and so they've encouraged all this mining. Mining of minerals, and they don't know how to do it with, you know, in a safe way, and so water runs off from the mines, and, you know, or it's probably dumped out of the mines. I mean, you have to pump water out of mines, and it goes into the rivers, and that river water is used to irrigate the fields, and then the rice gets, you know, particles of cadmium
polluted.
It gets polluted to where it's poisonous.
So they couldn't sell the rice.
Oh, they can't. No, I mean, there's whole villages that are now destitute because their rice crop is worthless. And so I actually live in Hunan and buy rice from Thailand, which is another major rice-producing area. But it'd be like living in Kansas and buying wheat from the Ukraine. It's ridiculous. Like, they're making it right here, but I won't touch it. It's, you know, it scares me.
Yeah, wow. That is amazing. You were telling me also about the food crisis in general.
Yeah, you know, so one of the things I was reading, actually on the airplane on the way back, it was an article in the China Daily newspaper. It's English, actually government-run newspaper, so you got to take it with a grain of salt. But they were talking about how something like 65% of China's millionaires have either emigrated from the country or are in the process of emigrating, meaning leaving the country. And the two biggest reasons of why they're leaving isn't taxes. They're going to countries with higher taxes. Why are they doing it? The two biggest reasons are air quality, or pollution in general, but especially air quality, and food, what they call in China food safety. And these are really big issues in China. I mean, you know, my students, when they are learning English, you know, they have articles that are, you know, like things from the news that are relevant. And the two main topics that they're learning about and they're reading about are food safety and pollution. These are the two major crises of China. You know, when you talk to somebody in China about, you know, freedom of speech, and their only concern is that they're able to express their dissatisfaction with the air quality and the food safety. Meaning that's the only concern really about the freedom of speech that they have, is that the government doesn't cover up what happens with the food safety and the
pollution. And if you have the means and the money to relocate, then you certainly take advantage of that.
65%.
So you've been back.
Can you imagine that?
65%. That's an enormous amount.
And the other people can't leave. Heavens. They can't afford it.
No. So what is to be done? So now you speak with so many students. You're teaching English there in China, and you've been back for a number of days now. You wanted to mention something about yesterday's class, and something to do with the difference between truth and lies. Fill us in. Right.
So I gave my first lessons yesterday. My first two classes I had, for almost 6 weeks or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I decided I would talk about the topic of truth, of telling the truth versus lying. And the reason is that, mm-hmm. In my travels, one of the things I really encountered, and I kind of knew this in a vague sense, but I didn't know to what extent it was true, is that Chinese people are liars. And I want to make it clear, I'm not saying this in a racist way. It's not a racial issue. It really is a cultural issue. It's a function of their culture. And from their perspective, I don't know that they're necessarily liars, but from our perspective, they are. And I'll give you an example, and this is a trivial example, but most of the Chinese people I asked about this said, yeah, it's true, we do lie. We lie a lot. And so I was traveling with a bunch of people, two Germans, who I had some fascinating conversations with about the Holocaust, two Germans, an American, me, and a Chinese woman. And we're hiking through this mountain. And we come across this little you couldn't even call it a restaurant. It was like some villager on the side of the trail who was selling food. And this villager desperately wants us to buy some food. We're probably the only people who came along all day. And we're just not interested. Mm. We're hiking. And we're not interested in her, unhygienic, disgusting food. so we say, no, thank you. And she keeps pestering us. And she actually starts following us. And finally, the Chinese woman we were hiking with says something to the villager. And the villager goes away. And we're hiking along, and the Chinese woman is glowing. She's so proud of herself. Why is she proud of herself? Because she told the villager that they're Westerners. They don't eat Chinese food. They only eat Western food. Meaning about us. Right. And so the villager heard this and said, okay, I'm selling Chinese food. They won't eat my food because they're Western.
She was placated, and she went away.
And she went away, and we heard this, and we were horrified. We said to the Chinese woman, so you lied. And you lied in our names about us. And you lied in a way that makes us look xenophobic and narrow-minded. And, I'll eat Chinese food as long as it doesn't have pig and, other disgusting things I can't eat. Sure. There's nothing about Chinese food per se that I'm opposed to. This Chinese woman, we said, you lied. And she said, but I made the woman feel good. We said, yes, but we feel bad because you lied. And you lied for us. And she didn't understand it. And I've heard this time and again from people, both Chinese people and Western people. There's this great frustration that the Chinese people lie. And I'll give you an example from the school that I work at, and maybe I've shared this before. We had this 5-day power outage, no electricity for 5 days. What happened? Mm-hmm. Well, the school has a business dispute with a local land developer who for some reason has an electrical switch to the entire school. And at will, he can turn off our electricity whenever he likes. Wow. And so the electricity went out, and this was the 27th time it happened in the last 3 years.
Oh, my goodness.
I have to admit, so I've only been at the school for 6 months, and it only happened 3 times or maybe 4 times while I was here. And but I knew what was going on. It was the developer turning off the electricity. Sure. So I call up the person who is our liaison for the foreigners. Mm-hmm. That's her job to deal with the foreigners. And I say, well, what's going on? And she says, oh, there's a power line down and they're working to fix it. And I say, oh, okay, so it's not the developer. Wonderful. Ooh. 24 hours later, there's still no electricity. I call her back. I said, come on, power line. She said, well, I heard a rumor that it was this, this warlord, this land developer. And then another 24 hours later, she finally admits, yes, it's the developer. And now I can tell you, officially, it's the land developer. So the first time she lied to us, the second time it was kind of a half lie, half truth. And finally, she admitted the truth. So why did she do that? From her perspective, she's making us feel better.
It's diplomacy as far as she's concerned.
Well, from my perspective, here's what I hear. and maybe this is me, I don't know if this is every Westerner, but what I hear is, you must think I'm really stupid that I'm not going to know you're lying. You're saying something so obviously a lie, you must think I'm an idiot. And so I'm actually insulted by this lie. It doesn't make me feel good. It makes, just tell me the truth. I'm an adult. I can handle it. And I'll give you an example from that happened recently in China. There was a terrorist attack in Tiananmen Square. That is probably the most sensitive spot in China, Tiananmen Square. This was about 3 or 4 months ago. Tiananmen Square is equivalent in the United States of the Washington Monument. Now, imagine if someone went and blew up the Washington Monument, or you know what they actually did is they drove a car and tried to blow it up into Tiananmen Square. Only a few people were killed, dozens were injured. So, what would happen in the U.S. and maybe Australia if this happened? If someone or they drove their car into the lawn of the White House, what would happen? Well, it would be in front page news, and the president would get on the news and say, this is what happened.
It was an incident, and this is how we handled it, and we're on top of it. And
we have it under control, and we're going to get the people who did this. What China did, the first thing they did is they went on Weibo. Weibo is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter. And the government in China has direct access to Weibo. So the first thing they did is they deleted hundreds of photos of the terrorist attack that people had posted on Weibo.
Wow.
Now, in the U.S., they would have to, at least I think they would have to, who knows now after the Snowden revelations, but presumably what they're supposed to do is file a court order and get a some kind of court order to delete the photos. No, and they literally went into the servers of Weibo and directly deleted it without even telling Weibo what they were doing. They deleted the photos to cover it up. They denied it was a terrorist attack. They said it was a traffic accident. So basically, after about 5 days, the news report did get out. It was in the international press. And the some low-level government official went on the television and finally admitted, yes, it was a terrorist attack, and we found this jihadist literature in the car, and they were Muslims. They were Muslims from Xinjiang who are non-ethnic Chinese, and one ethnic Chinese Muslim who together conspired and carried out this terrorist attack. But it's not a big deal, and we're on top of it, and don't worry about it. And to this day, most of my students still don't know what happened.
Really? So let me just ask you, because I just want to get this clear. What is the motivation behind covering it up? Is it to save face from the fact that they were able to get that far?
No, to make the people feel good. What you don't know, you don't have to worry about what you don't know about.
So ignorance is bliss.
Ignorance is bliss, so let's keep the people ignorant. And it's okay to lie to the people. They won't even be upset when they find out. It's this is what we do. We lie. And don't get me wrong, the American government lies as well. This has come out with the whole Snowden affair. Governments lie. But the difference is that – and look, there's individuals in every culture who lie. There's individuals who kill and steal in Western culture as well. It's not like Americans or Westerners are somehow perfect and Chinese are evil. That's not the case at all. I mean, there's individuals in China who are extremely truthful. But culturally, by and large, lying is considered acceptable. And maybe we can say that their definition of what we might call in the West a little white lie is different than our definition. Mm-hmm. So in the Western world, I think most men, and I'm not among those men, but most men, if their wife or girlfriend asks them, does this make me look fat, they will lie and say, oh, no, it doesn't. You look wonderful in that. What I will say is, don't ask me a question you don't want to know the answer to.
Sure.
And if I'm feeling particularly diplomatic, I'll say, that's a really nice color. But I will not lie. And I tell people this, don't ask me a question if you don't want to know the answer. But in the West, I think most men will lie about that. So the Chinese definition of that, quote, little white lie is extremely broad. And it extends to the government telling the people that, oh, no, there was no terrorist attack. It was a traffic accident. Mm-hmm. And when they get caught, it's not a big deal because, of course, we lie. What do you expect? I mean, you know we're going to lie to you. It's not a big deal. So why is it that they're so comfortable lying? And I have a theory, and I don't know, it requires further study. But my theory is this. That and it's not just my theory. I've read this as well, but this seems to confirm it. That Western culture, the Jewish heritage, what some people in the West will call the Judeo-Christian heritage, is based upon the concept of guilt. Our entire culture, without us realizing it, is based on guilt. Mm-hmm. And the Eastern culture, Chinese culture, and those other countries around there, Japan included, are based on shame. Now, what shame so what has to the, do...
How do we define the difference between shame and guilt?
So, guilt is I do something and I feel bad even if nobody knows about it. You only feel bad about... In China, they only feel bad about something if they're caught because that brings shame. Or maybe they feel bad because they're afraid to get caught. So I gave this scenario yesterday to my students. I said, if you're walking by the bank and there's $1 million there, $1 million, that's 6 million Chinese yuan, and there's no one around, and you can take it, and you will not be caught. I guarantee you, and you can't be caught. No one will ever know. Would you do it? And one student I called on, she said, it's too scary. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, someone will find out. So it's not about, oh, it's bad to take the money because it's not mine and it's stealing. It's about shame. I will get caught and my family will be shamed.
Right. And this comes back to, as you told us about before, the concept and even philosophy of saving face, right?
Absolutely. It's about shame. So if nobody will know, and if I really know no one will know, then it's okay to do whatever I want to do. And there's no boundaries. Now look, this isn't 100%. Chinese people do feel guilt. But my estimate would be that their emphasis on guilt is maybe between 10 and 25%. And then shame is the rest, you know, 75%. Whereas in the West, I think it's the opposite. We have shame as well. But it's not as important as it is, as guilt is. Now think about what guilt is about. So guilt, if you really analyze it and think about it, I think for most people in the West is that maybe no human will know, but God will know. Mm-hmm. If I take that money, God will know. So in a sense, it's very similar to shame, but it's shame in the presence of God.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
So it's actually a profound difference. And so think about what the Chinese have done. So with their emphasis on the family and society, you're being shamed by family and society, is they've made their family and their society into their higher power, into God.
That could be a fair conclusion. I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, they're in the presence of the family and society is what they're concerned about. God, you know, there many of them are atheists. Most of them are atheists. And the ones who have God, well, those are gods who aren't really concerned with them. Mm. You know, they're distant, you know, gods. They're not.
Whereas Western the Judean Christian culture, if you like, is held to a higher authority.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we call it a higher authority, but they would say that their family and their society is the ultimate authority. Mm-hmm. And this actually explains a lot about Chinese culture. It explains why the Chinese government feels it has the right to suppress 1.5 billion people. Mm-hmm. They see themselves as custodians of Chinese culture, essentially as the god of China. And if they don't hold it together, then, you know, China will disintegrate into hundreds of little different principalities and countries, which is probably true, because there is no one China. It's hundreds of different cultures and ethnic groups that are forcibly being held together. And so they essentially see themselves as God. They need to do this. They need to protect the people from, you know, disintegrating into what they see as chaos.
Right.
And they see themselves as the heirs of the emperors. And the emperor saw himself as the title of the emperor was Son of God. God was the Father in heaven, and the emperor was the Son of God. Right. And so the Chinese Communist government has abolished God, and so they're directly God.
And this is, you got to travel to get a broader sense of the philosophies of different cultures, because it's so easy to take for granted that everyone just thinks like me around the world.
Exactly. It's exactly right. And you know, and I actually had an intense conversation 2 days ago with one of the people I work with who was behaving what in the West would be considered a very unprofessional way. And I tried to explain to her that you cannot interact with Western people this way. We have a different culture. And if you speak this way to us and talk to us and interact, if you lie to us, it's very, you know, disrespectful and unprofessional. And she said, oh, no, we're all the same. And I said, this is exactly your problem and why you're behaving this way, because you don't realize that we're not the same. We have different backgrounds. Maybe genetically we're the same, and we are genetically the same and biologically the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like I'm a PC running Linux and she's a PC running Windows, and we don't function. We look very similar. The interface is very similar, but there's different functionality. And yeah. this emphasis of shame versus guilt, I think, is a key difference that explains many things about, you know, Western society. And again, it's not everybody in the West. In the West, generally, if somebody doesn't have an intense sense of guilt when they do something wrong, we call them a sociopath. Mm-hmm. We identify it as a sign of mental illness.
Mm.
In China, there's nothing sociopathic about it. Why would I feel guilty? There's no God to be concerned about. As long as I don't get caught, everything is fine. And like I said, it's not 100%. But 75% of it is, you know, shame. It is a little bit of guilt. I'm not going to feel too guilty because they'll do the same thing to me. That's how many Chinese people think. Everybody does the same thing, you know. So there are these different cultural values. And if we don't understand those cultural values, we could get, you know, that's the source of a lot of that's the source of racism. You know, one of the things I always thought growing up with the liberal Jewish values is you need to treat everyone the same. Everyone is identical. There's no difference between different groups and different races. And when I went to university and I took these courses in anthropology, which talk about the differences of culture. And at first I was very resistant. I said, no, that's not true that we have these, you know, everybody's an individual. Culture's got nothing to do with it. And as I studied more and more of it, I realized the failure to understand the differences is what causes racism.
Mm. And it's like, listen, look, I'll be honest. It's like when I go to Israel, and we've spoken about this before. When I go to Israel, I know that the Israelis are much more blunt and straight to the point. Where my culture would call that rude. But as I've said to people, you got to expect this of them because this is just the way they are. They're not trying to be rude. They're just more upfront and far more blunt. And we would be more inclined to perhaps sugarcoat things verbally. They don't take the time to do that. And
right. So the way they would see it is that you're evasive and dishonest.
Right. Sure. So it's much better to be when you're there to be upfront and straight to the point and call it what it is.
Whether it's better or not, you definitely need to know the difference and realize this is not someone trying to disrespect you.
That's a good way of putting it.
Take for example, and I don't know if you experienced this, but if you've ever gotten on a bus in Israel or stood in any kind of, quote, line or queue, as the British call it, you will notice that it's not the same as the Western concept or the American concept, I should say. I don't know about Australia. I was warned when I came to China. They said when you go to the supermarket, it will be very difficult standing in line because everyone pushes to the front. And I laughed and I said, trust me, I'm not going to have any problem. And I didn't.
No, you're used to that.
I felt perfectly at home. In fact, I was in the front of the line usually. I'm like, these people must not really want to be in this line because they're not making any effort. So, and it's not that I'm rude. It's just a different cultural value.
It's a different cultural value in Israel.
Now, if I did that in America, it would be rude, which is why when I get off the plane – actually, before I get on the off the plane, when the plane lands in Israel, if you're on El Al, you'll notice everyone pushes to the front. And if somebody is, you know, getting their bag and organizing their stuff, they're just going to wait. They've got no choice because the other people will push past them. When you land in the airplane in the U.S., it's bizarre to me because there'll be somebody in the row in front of you and they're fiddling around with their stuff and they're not doing anything and people are waiting for them. And I don't understand why they're waiting. Oh, because they're in front. Yes, but they're not going. So why wouldn't I go? So I have to actually do a mental switch and say, okay, I don't want to be disrespectful. You know, when in America, do as the Americans, as long as it doesn't, you know, violate my
and you
Torah
acknowledge
values.
That in advance and you accept that and expect it. And when it happens, you go, of course, I'm in a different culture and I understand how they think. Let's return, if we can, because we're running out of time. If we can just return to Israel, because the people are now saying, well, Nehemiah's in China. He's teaching English in China. He's still there, but isn't he meant to be in Israel doing the Aviv search?
So this is actually so for those who don't know, the Aviv search is where we go around Israel and we examine the barley crops to determine whether there will be a 13th month in the Hebrew calendar, whether the Feast of Unleavened Bread will begin this year in March or it will be in April, and that will take place at the end of February, the beginning of March. And for 22 years, I believe it was 22 years, I every year was in Israel for the Aviv search. And there were years when I actually wasn't in Israel and flew specifically for that purpose. Mm. And this is the first time in 23 years that I will not be in Israel for the Aviv search. Let me repeat that. I won't be in Israel for the Aviv search. However, there are people who are who have, you know, gone in previous years and have experience and they are qualified and have my full trust and confidence, and they will be carrying out the Aviv search. Some of them are people that you know from this program. Yoel and
Ben Shlomo, yeah.
Yeah, Yoel Ben Shlomo and Keith Time Will Tell Johnson is going to be on the Aviv search. And Bruce Brill, who was involved in the Aviv search over 10 years ago. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, in the late 90s he got involved. Or early aughts, anyway. No, the late 90s. And, yeah, so we've got
a wealth of experience.
Quite a team, wealth of experience. And I have full confidence that they will be able to carry out the Aviv search.
You're not going to be there, but they are going to be there. And as we said, there is a wealth of experience. There is a team that is doing the Aviv search so that everybody who subscribes to that, and incidentally, you can keep up to date via the Karait Corner newsletter. Is that correct?
That's correct. Karait Corner newsletter. You can sign up at karaitcorner.org for the free Karait Corner newsletter. And I would ask that people who think this is important that they send in contributions because this costs money. It all costs
because
money.
Because it's no small exercise. There's a lot of travel involved and a lot of people's time involved to be absolutely conclusive.
Right.
Can we talk about that a little bit? Because sometimes you hear people say, why is the Aviv search so expensive? Why? Well, just break it down for people.
Well, first of all, it's funny. A few years ago, I took a group of Americans around Israel, and there were two families. And so what we did is we rented two cars for – it was 2 weeks. So two cars for 2 weeks. So one of the guys got really upset. He said, for the price it's going to cost me to rent a car for 2 weeks, I could buy a car in Minnesota. And you know what I said to him? I said, you ain't in Minnesota.
That's right.
And in Israel, things are very expensive. Israel, you can look this up online, has one of the highest prices of gasoline in the world, or what the British call petrol. Gasoline is I believe it's somewhere above $8 a gallon, which is – to an American is that would be the end of the American economy if gas was $8 a gallon. Most people actually pay upwards of $6 a gallon. So that's not unusual. But that degree of it is unusual. So really what it involves is people getting in cars and driving around and looking at fields. And Israel actually has five distinct climatic zones. And it talks about, the beginning of the harvest in Israel. So if I were to just look at my backyard in Jerusalem, I wouldn't necessarily find the beginning of the harvest in Israel, which is in Leviticus 23. I would find the beginning of the harvest in Jerusalem. Well, the land of Israel is
much bigger than the land of Jerusalem, right?
Yeah, it's five climatic zones. And the two areas that through experience we know to ripen earliest are what's called the northern Negev, which you know is officially a desert, but when you go there, doesn't look like the outback of Australia. Well, actually, I haven't been to Australia, so I don't know. But I imagine it doesn't look like the outback of Australia. It doesn't look like the Mojave Desert or the I've been in Death Valley in the U.S. It doesn't look like Death Valley. It actually has quite a lot of agriculture. It's actually where Abraham in the Genesis, it says that he was a shepherd in the area of Gerar, G-E-R-A-R, and that's exactly that area of the northwestern Negev. And what the shepherds would do is they would plant a crop, and then they would roam around the desert with their sheep, and then they would come back when the crop was harvestable. And to this day, there are Bedouin who grow crops there, and that's one of the major areas of barley production historically.
Right. Wow.
And the other area is also the Jordan Valley. So those are two areas that the two main areas that need to be examined. And look, if there is Aviv, it's very simple. You go and you find a couple fields and you're done. But if there's not Aviv, you have to keep looking. Because essentially what you're trying to do is prove the negative, which is always very difficult. You're trying to show that there is not Aviv. And so if you can't find Aviv, then you have to keep looking and keep going. And it's a lot of stress and a lot of driving.
So you've really got to – but you have to take a satisfactory – sample. And that involves driving to the extremes of Israel to see whether or not the barley is in the state of Aviv. And this is why not just the cost of hiring a vehicle, but also the cost of petrol, gasoline, as you say. And then there's accommodation, and then there's traveling costs and so on and so forth. These are the things that add up, and they certainly do add up. But I mean, Nehemiah, often another question that might arise is, why can't you just get the – I mean, you said there's the Bedouin are out there, and so everybody's owns a field. Why can't you just get a farmer's registry? Can't a farmer go out and say, well, here's a field, here's some photos, and this is the state that it's in, and put it on a website or something like that?
So I've been doing it, like I said, for 22 years, and have attempted to do that. I have, you know, begged farmers, cajoled farmers, urged farmers, and they just don't understand the type of questions that we need to ask for Aviv barley. So really, you know, Aviv barley has to do with it's a stage in the ripening that would have been relevant, you know, thousands of years ago, really before modern farming techniques. But with modern farming techniques, they use a combine to harvest, and when you're using a combine, you're dealing with a different situation. You're not, when you're harvesting by hand, you need to know when the crop is in a very specific state that when you harvest it, it won't fall apart. But when you harvest it with a combine, it has to be much drier, the crop, actually more ripe, and you want it to fall apart. That's exactly what you're aiming for, that as you harvest it, you can instantly shatter it and have seed. So I've tried to explain this to farmers, and they understand the concept. It's just not something that they can wrap their heads around fully and embrace.
That's understandable.
Yeah.
So this is what you say. You're not going to be there. This is the first of
you. I won't be there the first time in 23 years. But if people want to support it, which I strongly urge, they can go to nehemiahswall.com and they can make a donation, or they can go to makorhebrew.org and make a donation. That's MAKOR. Makor Hebrew. Makor is the Hebrew word for source, the Hebrew source. MakorHebrew.org. For those in the U.S., this is a 501c3 tax-deductible donation.
Okay.
So please go ahead and do that. And those who don't want to do it over the internet can call up Dev Daniel, the cultured Karaite, and she will be able to process a payment on the phone. Her phone number is 682-552-5772. You can also send in a check to makorhebrew.org, to Makor Hebrew Foundation, and you can send that to P.O. Box 535-579, Arlington, Texas 75053. So you can do it on the website, makorhebrew.org. You can do it by phone to Dev Daniel, or you can send in a check. And
Or nehemiahswall.com. So what we'll do, Nehemiah, let's put all of those links and details under this post so that people can...
Excellent.
Click on it and go straight to those particular links, and so that they, if they desire to contribute to the Aviv search, the up and coming Aviv search, and the team that is conducting that, including Yoel Ben Shlomo and Keith Johnson, regulars on this program, they can do that and keep up to date on the Karaite Corner newsletter. So that is the latest. That's all the news. My goodness, there's a lot of news, and it's been a while since you and I have caught up. So thank you for coming back on to Truth to You and filling everybody in.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Always, always a privilege to have you on the program, my dear friend Nehemiah Gordon. In the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.